Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, celebrity interviews, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Now celebrating 17 years of broadcasting success, here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again, both for our radio audience here in Mississippi at WYAD 94.1 FM. We welcome you all back to our program. Also, just tuning in through our online affiliates around the world, we're glad you all could be with us as well. I'm excited to welcome back to the program today Victoria Law. She's given us another great book this year about a subject that we've probably been hearing a lot about, and that's when it comes to incarcerations, especially mass incarcerations. Her new book is called Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 other myths about mass incarceration. We'll talk to Victoria not only about the writing of this book, but why this has been a topic that she's devoted so much of her time and efforts to, and what she hopes her book does to the conversations that are taking place right now about prison reform. Victoria, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me back, Cyrus.
So, Victoria, as I mentioned, you and I spoke last time about this particular topic, but in a different angle. What is it about prison reform and the need for it that keeps you coming back to this issue to be able to address it with the world?
Well, part of it is the fact that we have this gigantic prison population and so many injustices and abuses, including ones that we would not put up with or tolerate on the outside, continue to happen behind bars. So it's an issue that I visit again and again. There are so many horror stories, but there are also so many stories of resilience and resistance in places that seem like there should be nothing but despair and bleakness.
Yeah. And I think all of us in some form or fashion, Victoria, are impacted by this, and either having relatives or friends that are, inside of the prison system, or just, as you said, we hear about these stories. This new book, though, Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration, is interesting because you do address things that we do hear about, and you kind of allow us to see the truth of it. What was it about this topic of addressing the myths that made you say that's what you wanted to do with the new book?
Over the past, I've been reporting on prisons and mass incarceration for something like 20 years, and it's only been over the past few years that I've been seeing more mainstream interest in the topic of prisons, of the topic of mass incarceration. I was seeing people who normally don't think about prisons and don't think that prison issues affect them, looking at the issue more and talking about it more. But I was also seeing that people's understandings of both what happens inside prisons as well as what's driving mass incarceration fall into rely on myths that are just not true. And if you are not understanding the root causes of imprisonment, if you think that, say, private prison corporations drive mass incarceration, then you're going to be looking for solutions that don't necessarily get to the root causes of the problem, and instead either put a Band-Aid on the problem or perhaps expand the prison system in other ways that people hadn't thought of before.
And I think, too, one of my big takeaways from the book, Victoria, is that you address something that we're hearing more about now, that typically when we're discussing the topic of, of mass incarceration and the criminal justice system, we think about black men. You also show us that another thing that we've been hearing a lot about, that women are sometimes forgotten in so many different respects, even when it comes to this topic. What was that like for you to shine a spotlight on, to show that this was not just one group of people that were impacted by this, but there were those who were impacted that are sometimes forgotten or not even thought about?
I started doing prison reporting, focusing specifically on women in prison back in the early 2000s when people weren't really talking about women in prison. So I'm used to looking at the people who are often forgotten about, even in the infrequent conversations we were having at the time around mass incarceration. So people weren't really looking at women in prison because they made up about 10%, they continue to make up between 7 to 10% of the nation's incarcerated population. So for me, it was looking at what their issues were, which were all the same issues that face men in prison, terrible medical care, racism that is rampant within prisons, brutality, violence, separation from their families, as well as issues that men in prison do not face because of the way either society is gendered or bodies are gendered, such as being the primary caregiver or parent of young children. And for an incarcerated mother, she is more likely to have children end up in foster care than an incarcerated father, reproductive health care, sexual abuse by staff members as well. So if I was looking at what happens inside women's prisons as a sort of way to look at a larger picture of all of the ways that prisons create and inflict violence and trauma upon people inside. And if you only look at men in prison, even though they make up the majority of people behind bars, you leave out so many other ways that prisons and other systems of confinement continually violate the rights and dignity and bodies of those who are held inside.
Yeah. And I think that's it. And I think that's why a book like this reminds us of that, but also I think gives us the real stories. And that's another thing that you're able to cover. You know, my home state of Mississippi makes an appearance in this book, unfortunately not in the best of ways. One of the things that you talk about in the book is the way that that offenders are treated versus in some states where there's in others. I want to read what you wrote, Victoria, and we can talk about it. And because I think this is an interesting thing, something I didn't know. In Chapter 9, people in prison jumped the line for life-saving medical care. You write this: in addition, some states such as Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, my home state, South Carolina, and Texas, pay incarcerated people nothing for their work, still charge them copays for medical care. In 2011, Texas legislators changed the state's prison copay system to a flat yearly fee of $100. But imprisoned people can avoid that extravagant price tag by eschewing medical care, and it seems they do. In 2014, 3 years after the copay system changed, only 15,000 of the nearly 150,000 incarcerated Texans pay the $100 health care fee. And I think this is becoming more an issue, especially in the world of COVID, right, Victoria, where we're seeing, I know here in Mississippi, we had over 50 inmates that died last year in prisons. What was that like for you to look at the way that inmates are treated or not treated when it comes to their health care?
Well, it's horrific, for one thing. We have to remember, in our country, in the United States, there is no universal health care. I mean, you can go to the hospital emergency room if you are in, you know, if you are having an acute medical crisis, but there's not the ongoing right to care. People in jails and prisons actually are the only population within the United States that have a constitutional right to health care because the Supreme Court ruled that they do. But the Supreme Court did not say what kinds of health care they should be able to access. It doesn't have to be at a certain level of adequacy. It doesn't have to be timely. And we see again and again that prison health care, and I put care in quotes, often fails to provide adequate and timely treatment. And this can also at times be lethal. We see this again and again during the coronavirus pandemic that has swept the nation, including its jails and prisons this past year, where people in prison and jails were not given access to PPE. They were not allowed to go get COVID tests in the very beginning. There was a horrific story here in New York City, where I live, about Rikers Island, which was an early hotspot of the coronavirus. And somebody who had been handling the food, like one of the men that passes food out to everybody else, had come down with COVID. And 8 people on the housing unit said, you know, I've also been feeling kind of sick. Maybe I have this new coronavirus, and asked if they could go to the medical clinic. At Rikers Island, as in many jails and prisons, you can't just get up and walk to the clinic. You actually have to be escorted by jail guards or prison guards to the medical clinic. And instead of bringing them to the medical clinic, the guards tear gassed them. Now, why you would do that when they obviously want to go figure out if they have a very communicable disease that could spread to everyone, including the guards, is beyond me, but I think it is emblematic of the type of quote-unquote care that people can expect while inside. And that's just the sort of like tip of the iceberg. There's also people who have been waiting long periods of time to get life-saving medical treatment, and sometimes people die rather than actually get the treatment that they are supposed to get by the Supreme Court's decision.
And that is why I think a book like this is so important, Victoria, which is why I'm glad we have you back on to talk about it. For those who are just tuning in, either on the radio side or online, you're listening to Conversations Live. Victoria Law is back with us discussing her new book, Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 other myths about mass incarceration. We're going to remind you how you can get the book for yourself, as well as, of course, stay connected with Victoria. Victoria, the other thing that you talk about as you are addressing these various topics are the way that people view prisons. Now, I have to admit, growing up, you know, I was told that, you know, prisons are where the bad people go. You know, that's just the way that I think we are, a lot of times we look at it. You say this, though, in the book about the way we look at prisons in Chapter 18, the system is broken and we simply need some reforms to fix it. You say, many people believe that prisons are necessary for safety and security. They fear abolition would simply open prison gates and push society into a Mad Max type of world. But that's not actually what abolition espouses. Mass incarceration drains resources that could be used instead to address underlying causes of criminalized actions and harm, thus promoting greater safety. Abolition recognizes this and, while calling for dismantling systems of mass incarceration, also advocates investing these newly freed monies and resources into communities and structural support. So we've been hearing a lot about mental health, and it's not in any way taking away from the horrible things that people are doing. But is that kind of what you're saying there, Victoria, that we need to be looking at why people end up doing what they do and put money there, like when it comes to mental health, instead of just thinking by building more prisons that's going to solve the problem?
Yes, that is definitely what I am saying. I mean, what we see clearly is that prisons become a place where you sweep all the people who have been failed by all of the cuts and the slashes to services and supportive institutions that people need to be able to live in this society. I mean, when we have slashes to affordable housing or limitations on who can live in safe and affordable housing, you then have more people who are either on the streets or living very precariously. If you cut mental health services, such as in Chicago, under the past mayor, Rahm Emanuel, he closed half of the city's community mental health clinics, which meant that people in poorer neighborhoods of color in Chicago, which meant that people who might have gone to one of those clinics, not only to get medication or counseling, but also might have started to build a rapport with a mental health counselor or a therapist that they saw on a regular basis, then we're left without anyone. I mean, there was an article that I read where somebody went and had finally found a counselor that he was building a rapport with, that he clicked with, that he felt comfortable sharing his thoughts and his feelings and whatever had happened to him previously to cause his mental health issues. And he showed up for his regular appointment, and the counselor said, well, they're closing this clinic. I don't know where I'm going to end up. Here is a list of giant hospitals that you can perhaps go to continue getting services, but I'm very sorry, best of luck to you. So when you have those types of cuts, what you're saying is we don't want to address underlying causes. We know that there are so many people who are in jails and prisons who are suffering from some form of mental illness. We also know that jails and prisons are not good mental health providers, either because they are stretched super thin, but also because the environment inside jails and prisons are chaotic, they are violent, they are racist, and they can exacerbate pre-existing mental health issues. So not providing the things that people need pushes them further towards the pathway to prison, whether it is simply because they are trying to do activities in order to survive, or because they get pushed further and further to either like the edge of some sort of mental health crisis or some sort of other crisis that that emboldens them or pushes them to act out violently against others. I mean, I don't know how often in Mississippi there have been reports of attacks against Asians and Asian American people, but here in New York and also in the Bay Area, there have been numerous attacks, and many of these people have been have numerous arrests, often for things stemming from their mental health issues that have gone unaddressed. And what happens is they do something, they're, you know, disorderly in public, they're urinating on something, they threaten somebody, they're running around in the middle of the street. The police are called, the police arrest them, they go to jail, maybe they spend a night or two there, maybe they're seen by mental health services, and then they're released. And you repeat this over and over and over, but you never get to the root cause of what is happening. And over time, their mental health gets worse, which means that the people around them might become more endangered, or they themselves might become more endangered because they are more vulnerable to other people's manipulations and abuses.
Victoria, as you were talking, I thought about what you discuss in the book about the justices, whether we're talking about restorative justice or transformative justice. Is what you're describing now, would that be considered transformative justice?
I think yes. If we are addressing not only the harm done to people, but also the conditions that embolden and enable that harm, then yes, that would be transformative justice. So for listeners who don't know, transformative justice is a way of looking at what to do when harm has happened. So acknowledging that we don't live in this peaceful, wonderful world in which people, you know, do not harm each other, but instead of just saying, we're going to lock you up and maybe you think about what you did, but maybe you don't think about what you did, but you're locked up for a certain period of time and nothing has changed about the circumstances that pushed you to cause that harm. So for example, and this is an example that I've been giving recently, given the attacks on Asians and Asian American people, and also as somebody who is very small, very female, and very Asian, is that transformative justice might be that I am walking down the street and somebody spits at me and punches me in the face. And I turn around and I hit him back with my meat cleaver or my hatchet or whatever, you know, implement that you want to imagine me carrying in my purse. And under transformative justice, and under the typical court system that we have now, we would both get arrested and go to jail. But nothing would have changed. Not what are the conditions that embolden this man to come up to somebody that he did not know and attack them based on their race or their gender or their size. Nothing would be addressed as to, like, is this person mentally ill? Does he have a history of mental health crises that have been remained unaddressed? What does he need in order to make sure that he doesn't do this again? And what do I need? Why am I carrying around a hatchet or an axe or whatever, you know, ridiculous implement I might be carrying in my purse? Like, what are the conditions that make me so fearful that I'm carrying around some ridiculously large and brutal weapon? And what needs to happen to make me feel safer and perhaps not, you know, feel like I have to defend myself in such a manner? So that would be transformative justice, where it doesn't just end. What do we both need? Maybe he needs mental health medications. Maybe he needs, you know, sustained mental health counseling. Maybe he needs to be involved in a program that has what we call wraparound services, where they're looking at all these different aspects of this person's life to be like, oh, well, you're living in a chaotic homeless shelter that's, you know, exacerbating your mental health issues. You know, let's try to find you some supportive housing. For me, it might say like, well, you know, you've been attacked before, which is why you carry around this giant weapon. You know, let's look at other safety strategies. Let's look at getting you counseling because you obviously have some unaddressed PTSD causing you to carry a weapon that is larger than yourself. So I also want to make clear that I do not carry a hatchet or an axe or a meat cleaver when I leave my house. But I give this example, and it's kind of a hyperbolic example because I want people to understand that, you know, transformative justice would look at all of these needs and the underlying conditions. So it might say, like, why is this man thinking that Asian people are his enemy? You know, oh, maybe it's because he's been, like, looking at these videos of, you know, people being punched on YouTube. Or maybe it's because there's been this constant barrage of blaming the coronavirus on China and Chinese people that is just, like, you know, inculcated in his brain. And how do we then, you know, begin to not only reverse that in his brain, but also challenge that narrative?
Is it disheartening to you, Victoria, that since the last time you and I spoke, that we seem to be going more backwards than forwards?
It is disheartening that there seems to be, you know, there seems to be an increase in certain types of violence since we last spoke. What is heartening is that what we see is that last summer there was after the tragic killing of George Floyd, there was this wave of protests and mobilizations and organizing, not only demanding justice for George Floyd, but also looking at the larger institution of policing as having enabled the killing of George Floyd. So that in itself is sort of a form of transformative justice organizing. I mean, we look at the police officer who killed him, Derek Chauvin, who had 18 complaints and 3 shootings, one of which was fatal, during his nearly 20 years in the Minneapolis Police Department that was not addressed. So basically the police were not, you know, being a police officer emboldened him to do these kinds of things. And again, there were not really any repercussions for him. So these demands to defund the police, to take money away from police budgets, you don't need a tank and, you know, a sound cannon and a this, that, and the other, and putting them into resources that help the communities is a form of transformative justice to transform the conditions that lead to so much violence and brutality. And what we see now with these heightened attacks on Asians and Asian Americans, who typically are thought of as more conservative, both financially and politically, is that there are some people calling for more policing, but there is also this groundswell of people saying, we don't need more policing because police have not done anything to keep us safe in the past. They often also are purveyors of violence and brutality when we call them into our communities. And instead, what we want are more resources, not only for our communities, but for the people who might, you know, be doing us harm. So what I'm also heartened by is that there's not a disconnect between these two movements. Last summer, there were lots of people of Asian descent that came out for Black Lives Matter protests, and they held signs that pointed to the little-known connections between Black and Asian solidarity movements. And then at the same time, what we see now is them saying, no, we're not going to walk back our solidarity. We understand that more policing means that the police will disproportionately target Black and brown people, but they may not keep us safe. I mean, in New York City, there are 36,000 sworn police officers, yet there's been this uptick in anti-Asian violence attacks, and 36,000 police officers have not deterred people from attacking, just as being in a prison, a nation that imprisons 2.2 million people has not deterred people from committing crimes.
It's such an important conversation, Victoria, which is why we're glad we have journalists and authors like yourself covering this and bringing this to our attention and making us think about these things differently, because it does impact us all. Again, everyone, journalist and author, Victoria Law has been our guest. Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration is her new book. It is available through our friends at Amazon.com or your favorite local bookstore. Victoria, how can they stay connected with you?
I am on Twitter at LVIKK. They can also look at my website, victorialaw.net. Tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, I'll actually be doing a virtual event with Madison, Wisconsin Bookstore, A Room of One's Own, so they can tune in then if they want to hear more about the book and about my work and about how it ties into what's been happening today.
All right. Victoria, congratulations. See you again. Glad we had a chance to catch back up, and looking forward to our next conversation together.
Okay, great. I look forward to it. Thanks again.
All right. You're welcome. And we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live. Now let's go make today amazing. Take care.